I'd like you to come up and give us the word.
Thank you. It's very good to be with you again. I've been making these trips to Ottawa for some time now and been visiting you from time to time, so it's very good to be back. At the last minute, I've changed my mind. I'm not speaking from Romans 14 after all. When I discovered that my friend Jonathan was going to be here as well, I so much wanted you to meet him and for you to hear a part of his story. And in these years that I've been coming here, the face of the Canadian church has continued to change, and to change a lot. From two immigrant churches, and one of them was with Jonathan, plants in 2002 to about 40 immigrant churches and church plants today are affiliated with Vision Ministries Canada. So that's a big change in quite a short period of time. And so we are now connected with churches from China, from Myanmar / Burma, from Ethiopia and Eritrea, India, Congo, Iran, Philippines, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Uganda. And so we're connecting regularly with people from all around the world, but these churches are all here. And so there has been this incredible change, and there are some very famous migrations in the Bible. We might think that, oh, this is only happening in our time. But when you think Abraham was called to leave his father's house, that God told him to leave the country where he was and go to a place where I'm going to tell you. He wasn't, not a refugee, but he was an immigrant in the country that he went to. Jacob had to go to Egypt because of a famine. There was a lot of trouble in his country. There just was not enough to eat. And so God provided for him to go to Egypt, where he was really a kind of a refugee, but an invited refugee because his son was already there. Moses fled to Midian because of danger. And later God brought them to the promised land, but there were already people living there. And so God brought these Israelites in to displace the ones who had been living there and had been living in an awful way, and he used Israel as a hand of judgment on them, just as he used other nations on Israel years later. But I want you to notice that these migrations have been going on for a long time, and often it's associated with trouble. You hear me? Is there trouble anywhere? We used to have a song that asked that question. And now I'm saying, well, yes, there is trouble everywhere. So I just want you to notice these migrations in the book of Exodus. And then God said to his people Israel, you are to love those who are aliens. You yourselves were aliens in Egypt. So I'm saying this morning to help us capture the idea that movements of people from one country to another have been going on for a long time. And they are described, in fact, in the Bible. There was a day when Ruth and Naomi, or Ruth's family, fled to Moab because of a famine. And they left their own country. They left the promised land, the land of plenty, the land of milk and honey, which was no longer a land of milk and honey. And they fled to a land of Moab, where they were refugees, where they were on the fringe of society. David was hiding among the Philistines. God had anointed him to be the king of Israel. And here you have the future king of Israel hiding among the Philistines. He is a refugee from danger in a foreign land. You have the nation, the whole nation of Israel, exiles because of the judgment of God in 2 Chronicles 36. You see the point? People are on the move. And they're usually on the move because of trouble of some kind. Jesus himself, taken to Egypt because of danger in Matthew 2. Paul sent to Tarsus because of danger in Acts chapter 9. And Aquila and Priscilla fled to Rome because there was trouble. There was violence. Political oppression, danger, wars, and famine, and extreme poverty are forcing people to flee their homelands today. So there are massive migrations. Now, the biggest migrations are usually just to the country next door. It's not like all the refugees are going from Sudan to Canada or from Eritrea to Italy. Mostly, they're just going to the country next door. So the biggest numbers are not moving very far. Nevertheless, some have come this far, and we're noticing that in our country. They are leaving Africa, Asia, Latin America in large numbers, and of course, some have come to Canada. Many brothers and sisters from these countries are coming here with a vibrant faith in Christ, already well intact. Yesterday, 16 church leaders met here for fellowship and encouragement, and only three of us were Caucasians. So Danny and Les and myself, we were the hosts for the day, and we were meeting right in this room, and everybody else was from Africa or Asia, I think just from Africa and Asia yesterday. And so I've been coming for quite some time and meeting with these church leaders one-on-one, and for the first time yesterday, we brought them together here at Pine Grove. And so instead of me driving and zigzagging all over the city to meet with them individually, we brought them together here. And we had an excellent time, and Les was a very good host for us yesterday. And I have Jonathan with me this morning, and would you come up and just take this mic, Jonathan? When I knew that he was going to be here, I wanted you to meet him. We've been friends for quite a long time now, and Jonathan, I'm just going to ask you some questions, and so I remember what they are, I'm going to stay over here.
Okay.
But would you just tell us about the danger that you were fleeing yourself as a teenager?
This was back in the late 80s, and I was in high school when I was 14, turning 15.
So just talk to them.
Okay. trying to answer your question. Okay. So I trusted my life to the Lord and when I was in grade 10. And right after that, I was involved in high school Christian fellowship. My background is Lutheran, but when I was in high school, as I said, I trusted my life to the Lord, and I was active in ministry. And in those days in Ethiopia, where I was born, there was a communist regime, and the regime was totally against Christianity. And as you know, just communists were just, you know, atheists, and they wanted to destroy Christianity from the country. So it was extremely dangerous for me, and I was, they were...
Like, do you mean even as a 14-year-old or 15-year-old it was dangerous?
It was extremely dangerous to be just a Christian, and especially involved in groups, gathering with other fellow Christians of any sort.
So that mean you had, there were people right in the high school who would watch to see who was...
Yes, in high school they had spies, you know, people involved in the communist in the communist movement, in the communist regime.
So why did you flee?
And
where did you go?
Yeah, the government, the government noticed that the Christian movement was growing in high schools and in college and in the university. In those days, there were only three universities. In the university, it was very extremely dangerous. To be a Christian, so they tried to break that movement. And I was a leader of a small group in our high school, my name was known by the government. So some of our friends they were imprisoned, and
as teenagers.
Yes, as teenagers. Yes, yeah. And I had to flee the country, and I did. I fled the country. I fled from Ethiopia to the Sudan on foot. It took about a month and a few days.
And so this was kind of a casual walk that you were on?
It was extremely dangerous. I mean, I was 16 years old. I was 16 at the time, turning 17, and it was extremely dangerous. You pay some amount of money to the local people around the border, and they will lead you your way to the neighboring country, which
was
the Sudan.
How long was this walk on foot?
About a month. It took about a month. But
a month?
Yes, staying a couple of days in some places and then continue another day, a couple of days walk. And then you have to hide because there was movements of the government, the military was in you know they were trying to control the people fleeing the country, so you have to hide for a couple of days and then continue away. So there was scarcity of water, food, and everything. So it was extremely dangerous.
So you got sick along the way.
Right when I came across. Right when I arrived at the border to the Sudan, there wasn't any food, so we were just eating any food, we possibly find. So I ate some spoiled food, and from that spoiled food, I got food poisoning, and I was extremely sick. I was losing all the fluid in my body. It wasn't only me, but it was me and a friend of mine who was with me there. And after 3 days of being sick, he died right in front of my eyes, and they buried him there. And I knew that I was dying because it was an extreme case. There was no medical attention that I could get at that time. So it was an extreme case, and I knew I was dying. It was just a matter of time. The other friends the other people that were fleeing with me, we were about 28 young people, ages from 15 to about 28, 30. So I would see them. They would come and check on me if I was still alive or not. So I knew that I was dying. And because it was my mother's initiative that I should flee the country, I knew if the news would just break her. And I was really worried about my mom. There was an argument with my father that, they could just keep me there and whatever happened should happen. And my mother really insisted that I should leave the country. So I was concerned about my mom, and I prayed before the Lord at that point, because I was a believer. I knew that I would see, I would be in the presence of the Lord if I die. But just thinking about my mother, I prayed one prayer. Lord, I know that I'm dying, and I don't care if I die, because I know I will be in your presence, but I'm worried about my mom. So if you keep me alive, it was a very short prayer, but really desperate prayer, and I said, if you keep me alive. I had other dreams. My number one dream was to study medicine and become a medical doctor. So I said, at that point, if you keep me alive, I'll serve you the rest of my life. So that was a turning point in my life. And I prayed that prayer, and I went into, I lost consciousness for a few days. I don't know how many days, but I lost consciousness. And after a few days, I find myself in a very rural area in the Sudan, crossing the border, run by UNHCR. Very primitive.
Run by what?
By UNHCR, okay. United Nations Commission for Refugees. And it was a very primitive type of clinic. So they, I noticed that they gave me an IV.
Yes.
I was getting some kind of medical treatment, but I lost weight and I was just a skin and bone. That's how I could describe myself. I looked so awful. I mean, just skin and bone, literally.
So you can tell that he didn't die.
That's right. Exactly.
Yes. So Jonathan ended up making his way to Sweden. And he ended up getting his education there, got involved with an Eritrean church there. Actually, you were a Swedish citizen, right?
Yes, I am.
And you can tell because of his blonde hair and his blue
eyes. Yes.
And so what brought you to Toronto?
As I said, I didn't know. I just prayed that prayer that, Lord, if you keep me alive, I'll serve you the rest of my life. But I didn't know how. growing up, when I was a kid, I used to stutter a lot. I wasn't really a fluent speaker. You know, I wasn't. It was very unlikely that I would be a preacher or, you know, a teacher or whatever. And I didn't know how to serve the Lord. Maybe, you know, serving the Lord as a janitor in his house, or you know, whatever, anything. But I knew that I promised, and I needed to keep my promise. But you know, as the days go by, the Lord was just leading me step by step into ministry in the local church that I was involved in. And when I came to Sweden, I was in a camp, in a refugee, in a shelter, I would say. I was the only Christian. I was the only believer at that time in that place. And I felt very lonely. It was in the northern Sweden, about 350 kilometers above Arctic Circle. So you can imagine coming from the Sudan, like 48 degrees centigrade hot heat to minus 45 degrees centigrade cold. It was a huge shock. I mean, look at the difference. So I was there, and I was just praying, Lord, I'm here. I am alone. And the other Christians, the other refugees, they knew that I was a believer. And I was totally neglected. They just pushed me away. They didn't want to have anything to do with me. And I was just praying, Lord, why? What is the reason I'm here? And I kept on praying. And I started sharing my faith with some of those refugees. And suddenly, an elderly woman came to know the Lord. That's a long story, just giving you a short story. So she came to know the Lord, committed her life to Christ, and I started a Bible study with her. It was a huge blessing.
So how old was she?
She was up in her 60s.
And how old were you?
I was 23 at that time.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. And it was a huge blessing for me just to have a Bible study with her at her home and just teaching her. And other people started to come, and I shared my faith with those people. And these people, just one by one, we started to grow. And suddenly, I have a church plant in my hand. It just felt like the Lord just threw the ball, and I was just having a ball, a church plant right there. And that was the accidental church planting that happened to me, or an organic church planting. So I was praying, and I was taking care of these people. I didn't know how. I was just sharing the gospel, just teaching them about salvation in Christ, living a consecrated life to Christ, and holiness and everything. So that's the first church, and we became about 30 people in that area. So I was, so that's how the Lord led me into ministry.
Were you still stuttering?
Well, at that point, I think the Lord helped me, and I really managed to speak quite well. I still stutter sometimes, but it's I know how to go around it, and yeah, that's how. And this burden about church planting became, more heavy in my heart, and I was involved in other three church plants in Sweden. Then there was. My pastor at that time in Stockholm was visiting in North America, in America and in Canada, and he met with some people, few people in Toronto that didn't have a church but just gathering in a home, about 7-8 people. So he encouraged me to go and visit them and see the possibility to encourage them to become a church, and I came. I left my job. And I was newly wed. I just married. I got married in 1997, summer of 1997. I came to Canada end of 1999. So it was only 2.5 years with my wife, and I came to Canada for about 3 years just by myself. She was working there, trying to support me here.
I remember that you told me one time that you slept in a stairwell.
Yes, exactly. I did. It was very difficult, but for some reason, I don't know. I never felt bad about it, you know, because I knew I came here to, you know, as a missionary, Swedish missionary, and yeah, and I was trying to help these people, you know, get connected and establish a church, plant a church. So I wasn't supported by anyone. My wife was supporting me financially. Yeah, and then the number started to grow from 7 to 15, 20, and so on.
You weren't so worried about this, Terrell, but actually he slept there because he didn't want to be a bother to these small number of people that yes. were gathering. Isn't that
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. I mean, it was very difficult. I mean, living in Canada, I wasn't able to work. If I would work, then it would be illegal. And so I wasn't working. And at that point, I was staying with a family, and that family didn't come home to their place that particular day. So there wasn't anywhere to go. So that was my only option.
Mind you had been sleeping in unusual places all along.
Yes, exactly. But it was extremely unusual coming to Canada and having, you know, having been going.
So I just wanted to mention that Jonathan is now pastoring a church in Toronto called Mount Zion Worship Center. They meet at the Presbyterian Church, and I think how many Eritreans and Ethiopians are in the GTA?
Eritreans and Ethiopians are about in the whole GTA about 107,000.
Oh, 1,000. So not 50,000.
No,
150,000.
Yes, exactly.
And here in Ottawa, do you have any idea how many?
I would say about Eritreans about 7,000 to 10,000.
Really?
Yeah.
And Ethiopians?
About 25,000 or 30,000.
So, wow. That's and I just wanted to mention that Jonathan helps to shepherd a network of about 20 or so new Eritrean and Ethiopian churches in Canada. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And many of them are associated with VMC. What kind of challenges are those churches facing?
The main challenge for these churches are, you know, dealing with newcomers and trying to help them. When I say newcomers, it's just not you know, wow, I'm here in a new country. But these people are just gone through very challenging situations. Some of them very extremely traumatic experiences, being persecuted, being shot at. Some of their friends being shot at the border, leaving the country. They've seen extreme situations in their lives. So,
oh, by the way, so you're talking about Eritrea now, right?
Yes, yes.
So Eritrea is a little country off the edge of Ethiopia on the Red Sea, and it's kind of a crazy country, and has yes. been for some time. Very communist.
Yes.
And I would say more Mao than Mao.
Chinese themselves, yes.
And so people have been fleeing that country and going to... So when you see those ships or those overcrowded boats that are trying to get to Italy and Sicily and Spain, a lot of them are from Eritrea.
Yes.
And they have been going through awful times in their country. They've just had to leave.
Yeah. Eritrean refugees are the second largest number of refugees next to the Syrians. And many of them are just dying and crossing to Europe. Yeah.
So the challenges, I mean, I just look at us here this morning, and I don't, of course, I'm sure that all of you are facing challenges of some kind as well. But these are people who have their family members shot and killed and threatened. And so this is not unusual at all, is it?
It's not unusual at all.
No. Can't remember. So a lot of these people have stories just like yours.
Oh, yes. I mean, even sometimes my story becomes just, you know, very insignificant compared to what these people are going through. I was in Ethiopia visiting the refugee camps in Ethiopia, Eritrean refugees. And there were a group of people arrived the same day I arrived there, and I was talking to these people, and they said they were trying to leave the country, and they were about 10 people. So they said, let's go 5 by 5. You guys cross the border, and then we'll just follow. And then they watched their friends trying to cross the border, and they got shot and killed right there in front of their eyes. And the soldiers, they came and they buried them just in a mass grave. They just covered their bodies. And right when they left that spot, these friends that were watching them from afar, they crossed as well, exactly. They say they wanted to use the opportunity when the soldiers got back. They wanted to use that gap. And then I said, why would you just, I mean, it was an extreme case. And I said, why would you do that? How about if you just got killed just like your friends? And they said, I mean, it's living in Eritrea these days is equal to just being dead. So there's no difference. So if we make it, we make it. If we don't, we just die. It's better to die there than just living in the country. That's how much oppressing the government is.
So when you see people here, you may be walking by them on the street and you think, oh, well, they're newcomers and so on. But just think about it. This might be their story. And so you've been connected with us for quite a while. How would you describe our relationship?
Well, well, I've been tormented by VMC ever since I'm married. Okay, so one of the greatest blessings, I would say, that happened to me personally in connection to the ministry that I'm involved in, that is that the connection with VMC. Someone in our community living in Edmonton, he suggested that I should talk to Jay Garnett or Gord Martin, and it happened to be Gord. And I had a meeting with him the first time, and I didn't know how, that was our first meeting, and I didn't know what he would expect of me and how I should behave and everything. But I just prayed a simple prayer, and I, Lord, if this is your will that I should connect with these people, and these are the right people for me to connect with, doing the work of your kingdom, so be. So just give me your favor before him. And, I just prayed that the Lord would, do his will. And that's exactly what happened. And I was very happy with my initial meeting with Gord. And we continued meeting with him. And the encouragement, the coaching, the mentorship, and all the support that happened to me and the church plant I was involved in was a great blessing. So I could say without any hesitation, I saw a great flourishment in my ministry that I was involved in since I joined or I connected with Vision Ministries Canada. I was going through a lot of troublesome situations and things, and Gord has been there always with me, praying for me, encouraging me. So that's one of the greatest blessings that happened to me in Canada. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm going to come back to this, okay. And I will include Jonathan in that answer. So just be thinking about that. I'm going to speak to that a little bit.
Okay.
But thank you so much.
Sure.
I just wanted you to meet this brother. And So because I know that he will be an encouragement to you, and that his story is a blessing to me, and I'm sure a blessing to you, because God is at work in places and around the world in ways that we're unfamiliar with. And so I wanted you to hear from him. And I wanted to say a couple of things. Oh, I just wanted to just, I couldn't bear to come here and not show you this.
I was buried beneath my shame. Who could carry that kind of weight?
This is an Iranian church from Toronto, baptizing 26 people in August. This was a group of 26 people, all former Muslims, were baptized on August 19th. And this church in Toronto, who is the pastor, is a dear friend of ours, and they are very cautious about baptizing Iranian people because many of them want to be baptized in order to facilitate their immigration and their citizenship status in Canada. So they're eager to get baptized, but many of them for the wrong reasons. And so they're cautious. They want them to wait for 6 months or even a year so that they can tell whether they actually want to get baptized because of the reasons from the Bible or just because they want to satisfy Immigration Canada. But one of the things we're noticing is that frequently there's a gap between Caucasian pastors and churches and immigrant pastors and churches. So they have their conferences, we have ours, we know about them, but we're not really connected that much. And consider that the global church that is flourishing the most is in the global south and east, in Latin America, Africa, India, and China. The church is going gangbusters there, and that the church in the north and west is declining numerically as well as in vigor and national and cultural influence, so that in North America and in Western Europe, which was the heartland previously, today, that has changed. And we are experiencing that right now. The Church of the North and West has church history, has academic knowledge, material resources, experienced leaders, social and political freedoms, and we have institutional strength. We have those things. And those are actually true benefits that we have. On the other hand, the Church of the South and East have a more radical faith, more boldness in vision, evangelistic fervor, belief in the power of prayer, and more uninhibited joy. So something is happening. And yes, there are benefits that the Caucasian, the Western, and the Northern churches have, but there also are benefits that are coming from the South and from the East. It's just an important thing for us to be aware of. I'm not saying this to discourage us, but once in a while we have to tell the truth, that it's not like this is a real shock to us. We're aware that this is taking place. These statements are statements of generalization. There are lots of exceptions in both spheres, so it's not always true. But can we consider that we need each other? What about that? Couldn't we consider that, you know what, we actually need one another? We have things, there are things that we have as longtime Canadians. We are the host culture. And I've just been realizing how little we are aware of the strength that we have in being the host culture. There are things that we can offer and do as longtime Canadians. To bridge that gap, get to know at least one immigrant planter, pastor, or church member. And I know that you already have a Haitian church meeting here, so that is happening to some degree, but you know what? I've been around for a while now. And just because you have another church meeting in your own building in this same space doesn't mean that you all are getting to know them. Is that right? So some of you may be, but others of you are not. And I want to say to those of you that are not that you're missing out. Now, you may feel shy and you may feel like, well, I don't know, what do we have to offer and we're so different and the food is different and will they understand us? All those kind of things, those barriers. But we are sitting right in the same space. So we would only have to go from here to there. Or even sit in the same seat and wait a couple of hours. And you would be surrounded. And so for us to realize that to bridge that gap, it would be a shame for us to be right here and not fully take advantage of this opportunity that is right here, because these are our brothers and sisters. Yes, they might eat different food, and yes, their language might be different, but we are part of one body. Do we believe that? Yes? How about an amen? Yes. Visit their church. Just show up here when they're here and see if, now do they have their service in French? Yes. So just find out if there's somebody that can translate for you and tell you a little bit about what's going on so that you can follow along. It's not very difficult. But you need to hear their stories. You need to say, can I find one of these people that I could invite for coffee or tea or what do Haitians drink? Coffee or tea? What's that? Coffee. So invite them to your home for a meal. You know that people that look like me and like many of you, we don't actually invite each other to our houses anymore very much. But for them, for you to invite them to your home and for you to visit in their home means a lot more than you'd think. It's a big deal. So we are actually not such a hospitable culture. We're a lot more distant than many of them are. So for them, to be together and to be in each other's space and place is much more common. Now, so you asked, what could we do? And this is what we can do. That We are the host, people that look like me, and a lot of you, are the host culture. We have stuff. We have history. We have connections. When my wife and I were kids, 22 or 3, we went to South America. Suddenly, we had no connections. We didn't understand the language. When we called somebody on the phone, you know what? We can't see them. We can't correct anything while we're talking. You know, it's so difficult to make a phone call when it's not your first language. So to this day, I'm making phone calls for people from other language groups because it's so easy for people that look like me to say no to somebody when you're listening to them on the phone, their English isn't perfect, you're not sure if you understood, maybe I'll just say no. It's really easy to do that. And so just to make phone calls on their behalf, to spend some time together, but you know what? You'd have to do something different than what you're probably doing now in order to do this. It doesn't look real difficult. What do you think? Is this doable? Just with the Haitians. I know that at my home church in Waterloo, we have a Chinese church that meets upstairs. But the number of people who are willing to cross the line between the English and the Chinese church and to connect, it's a pretty small number that are doing it. And so I don't have to ask anybody. I know that this is difficult for many to do. But how can we believe that we are members of one body and not do this? We are all baptized by one Spirit into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, slave or free, and we were all given the one Spirit to drink. Is that true? Is that only true of Jews and Greeks, or is it true of Jews and Canadians and Ethiopians? Still true of Ethiopians? Because now that you've got Jonathan here, you can't say no to that. And they sang a new song. I've heard these verses my whole life. They sang a new song. You are worthy to take this scroll and to open its seals. Because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased men for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God. And they will reign on the earth. And there's going to be Ethiopians and Chinese and Colombians and Ecuadorians and people from Myanmar. And we're going to be serving as priests together. Couldn't we get a head start and learn to do it here? Because the people who are coming, when I'm visiting with Jonathan and their church and I'm listening to some of these ridiculously dangerous, awful stories, what I've noticed is that these people, for them, faith is not just a noun. It's also a verb. It's something that is acted on. People have said, if I die, I die. Maybe I'll be like the first five. And they have just given their lives into the hands of God. And so as I've listened to them, I have listened to a radical kind of faith that I have not needed to practice. I've been called on for that. But they have. And do you not think that they have something to bring to us? Should that be a surprise? If they've been through that kind of deep waters, wouldn't you expect that they're not going to come and announce it to us. You have to go to them. Because, yes. And I'm sorry, what's your name? Jill. So Jill is saying that she's been visiting some of these other churches and has learned so much from them, their reverence for God and for the Word of God. You know, we're in a place where in our country, the Word of God is a very held in very low esteem by the people in power in our country. And so we come together like this and we read it and we reverence it, but the people who are in positions of power are not very positive about this at all. And so people are coming, and they're coming, and they're saying, we thought this was going to be a Christian country, and we're not afraid to let our young people be with Canadian young people because of how, well, how dangerous their lifestyle looks. Isn't that right? Yeah. And so Jonathan has three boys. The oldest is 15. And so suddenly now, they're at that age where they're seeing that their Canadian friends from school are living and thinking a completely different way than what they're hearing at their church. So I just wanted to tell you about this. And so thank you. I could go really on and on about this. There's so much to say. But thank you for hearing me out. And please greet my brother Jonathan and ask him all kinds of questions, because it's a complete blessing to have him with us this morning.
Thanks, Gord and Jonathan. We will go on to the congregational prayer next.